Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm joined by Mark White, who is a principal engineer at Dunham. Hey, man, how are you doing?
Hi, good, thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me along.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about Dunham and the work that you guys have been doing from a friend at AWS, people like Heitor is always talking about you guys. So it's really good to really finally have you on the show and tell us about your sort of journey from running on-premises to moving to the cloud and using a serverless-first mindset as you build out new architectures and the new capabilities. I guess before we get into that, do you want to take a moment and just introduce yourself and explain to the audience what is Dunham and what's your responsibilities over there?
Absolutely. Thanks. Jan said, I'm Mark, one of the principal engineers, one of six of us, overseeing the engineering chapter at Dunham. I guess with our architecture, we're moving into serverless, as you probably gathered from why I'm here today. But first of all, Dunham. So Dunham are primarily a homewares market leader. We started on a market stall in Leicester, and we've since built a bricks and mortar estate of around 180 stores. But with everything moving online these days, we also saw that as an opportunity to capitalize on online sales. So back just before I started, a decision was kind of made that the current platform was not scaling to the aspirations we had. And we had an opportunity to really dive into how we could make it a kind of a platform that could serve our future need as well as the current need. But also things like cloud were emerging, there's the usual providers were available to us. But at the time, we had a director of engineering who made a decision within good faith that it would come and be fruitful for us, which was to have a target architecture of serverless. For us, that doesn't really mean that everything is serverless. That means that it should be our first mind thought. Things that are obviously suited to better placed, maybe their data centers or server instances across the platform, they do exist today. And as we migrated through, we were able to make those decisions as and when we needed to, but it was always with the mindset of being serverless first, which, as I'm sure anyone who's learned serverless coming from a server background, there's a bit of a mindset shift into exactly what you're controlling. All of a sudden, you're no longer writing code that is deployed in a certain way. That means it's very well governed by other teams, but actually you're a bit more free will. So in one respect, you have some great autonomy, but equally you do end up with a lot more hats to wear to ensure that you're delivering the best possible software solution.
Yeah, I guess it's always that great Spider-Man quote, right? With great power comes greater responsibilities. So
absolutely.
So all this control and things like that you have, which is great, but then at the same time, you got a lot of responsibilities on your shoulders on top of the actual job that you're supposed to do in terms of building new features and fixing bugs and all of that. Personally, when I was I guess back in the day, I was spending maybe about 70% of my time just looking after machines, essentially. They're spending maybe 20, 30% of the time actually working on features. And that's one of the things that the serverless has really just unshackled me and released me from a lot of responsibility that doesn't really add a lot of user-facing value. I mean, people expect them to be there, but they don't. I don't have to be the one to provide those capabilities, the scalability and all of that. I'm really happy that someone else is doing a better job than me to make those things happen.
Yeah, there is certainly a lot of comfort that we take. And I think it's almost taken for granted these days in terms of deploying a serverless architecture that it's almost, I'd say 90% of the time is secure by default. It's pretty well founded, and you can just use it with a really, really low cost, hand it over to us, because AWS has done such a great job at making their platform so scalable. Obviously, you pay for what you use. So if you don't necessarily have the customer traffic that you desire, you don't pay for the traffic. But then on the other side of the coin, right, you get lots of traffic, you get a nice little bill, which is generally quite challenging to optimize it, but in a fun way. I find the cost optimization piece quite interesting because there's so many moving parts and so many options to engineer solutions within serverless.
Yeah, I think that's where things like FinOps really comes in, where you start looking at the which part of the system, because you can, if you're using things that are pay-per-use, you can really sort of drill down to which components are costing you a lot of money. So at least you have the ability to kind of, narrow down the scope of your optimization. I remember back in the day when I have to optimize my servers, a lot of time is either, okay, just take a hammer to my entire code base and try to, you know, do things that may improve things by some percentage point. And then you do that with multiple iterations and see which one actually stuck and actually worked. Whereas now you have much more fine-grained visibility into, okay, which Lambda function is actually taking long to run and runs a lot. So we just optimize that one function. But certainly on high throughput systems, serverless components can still be quite expensive when you're running at a really big scale consistently. And I guess going back to what you said earlier about making that decision to go to the cloud and go to serverless first, when was the start of that journey?
So I've captured it as around 2018. So it was, I think, just a year before I joined Dunelm, which meant we were into it when I arrived as an engineer. But it was still a very empty landscape in terms of the community that exists today was not really available to us. So making that decision, whilst it was a decision to move to serverless, it did come for Dunelm as a replatform with a brand new front end as well. So the current system we were using was built up of WebSphere Commerce. So it had its own kind of front end. It had its limitations. So we were aware of those. And by moving across to a new front end, which we chose React for, the back end kind of needed to change anyway. So we had a really good opportunity to move into that space. Although, as I said, it's limited documentation, examples, what we know today just was not around. So we had to put our best foot forward and really learn on the job. We were in a great, great culture of, we had no internal capability, but we quickly built up expertise via contractors, via bringing people in that had more experience than we did, although experience at the time was probably quite limited across the serverless space anyway. Like you say, you call that Hator there, a key person that was able to invite us to meet with many people from AWS that were able to give us that internal guidance as well.
Yeah, I remember 2018, that was, in terms of the best practices or just practices in general were pretty light on the ground. And I remember, writing about things like centralized logging and distributed tracing, all of those days, things were just still really early. The tooling just wasn't quite there. So a lot of us were just building our own, I guess, coupling together multiple things to make them work. How do you test things? How do you do, multiple observability and testing? And, how do you build more resilient architectures? All of those things were just gradually, build up in the community, but also from AWS as well. Back in 2018, that was definitely a lot of challenges that we have to face. Well, we don't, luckily, don't have to really think about too much anymore.
No, and I think as we moved forward, as we built the platform out, we took small chunks in a quite a sensible way in the interest of the big word agile in the industry these days. But we bit off small little chunks, and as we did that, we were able to learn and grow. So whilst we may not have had the best patterns in place that we know of today, we certainly had patterns that were available. The ones I can think of is SNS to an SQS to a Lambda to fan things out, API gateways to orchestrate a lot of systems, microservices together. The communication was REST as opposed to what we could do now with event bridges and event systems. And although they may not have always been the right solution as we know today, it actually gave us the ability to go, well, we know how that works. So when you build a new system, it was, as we were growing the teams, it was really nice and really easy to say, we know how to observe and trace the distributed system of API gateway, Lambda, SNS, SQS, another Lambda, for example, with a database in the middle. They were very common patterns that we could use. We may not have been using the enterprise architecture descriptions for them, or we may not, but ultimately as a team, we knew exactly what we could deliver with them. And when we start bringing, because we are quite a large business now, but as you're bringing more people on, you get more people that are focusing on security, you get more people focusing on observability, performance, all those different pillars within what a software application is these days. And as they were growing, we could represent that quite easily. By including that common pattern at Dunelm, it allowed us to move quite quickly. And then we could go back to refactor as and when we know. It's just today I was listening to a Gregor talk from reInvent on the train down, which was talking about refactoring on serverless. And it's something I think is fascinating in terms of it's no longer talking about moving to serverless all the time. It's very much, okay, you're in serverless, what next? And it's really like, as of today, using those API interactions that are available for all those SDKs pretty much natively within AWS, and moving away from your application code doing those orchestration pieces. I think that's a real interesting, we spoke earlier about that maintenance overhead, but even in serverless, there is a different slant on maintenance. There's your node version runtimes with TypeScript internally, so node is for us, and keeping those up to date along with your security vulnerabilities and all of those package updates. It's still a maintenance requirement, but if you can remove that completely, like low code, no code, I guess, in a serverless slant, gives you that freedom.
Yeah, it's great to see things like step functions, and they just announced the support for public endpoints, which is really something that I've been looking for a while. And you got Event Bridge, you've got AppSync, you've got API Gateway, all have direct integrations so that you can really go, well, I guess for lack of a better term, functionless, so you don't have to write custom Lambda functions unless you really have some custom business logic that you need to encapsulate in your own code. So imagine there you're doing migration, you're doing one small piece at a time. So that's the classic strangler pattern. Was there any other, I guess, migration patterns that was useful for you guys along the way? For example, when you're moving from, like, it's a pretty common one that I get asked about is, okay, I've got this live system, I need to migrate it to, say, serverless. What do I do with my database? Are there any patterns for migrating my data to this to say DynamoDB without any downtime? Are there any sort of other patterns that you guys used as part of your migration?
I don't think, from memory, I don't think there were. And the reason for that was because of the new roadmap for a new system. Typically, the database was, in essence, quite removed from us. So it was easier, rather than migrating chunks of data out of it, we would actually, because of the new front end, the new back end, the new governance over the core systems, we were able to start quite fresh on those databases, and actually make it more microservice orientated. This microservice is focused on purely account management. This one is focused on purely products, rather than having to rely on that central source and migrating out. So we use SAP as our ERP internally, and we were able to get data. As soon as we could get data out, we could then replicate it in our own custom architecture, as opposed to keep relying on that central source and building it quite nicely. So I don't think we really had the opportunity to make use of other patterns that were available. But the strangler pattern was commonly used because just the way that the nature of things were, we'd almost have to rebuild both sides of it, and then we could turn it off, whether that be in parts more functionality, or in some cases just because of the nature of the business requirements or the priority of the system, it was a complete rebuild before deprecating the old.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. And I guess so, as part of the migration, I imagine you had lots of people that's already working at the company and are already used to doing things a certain way, in a serverful way, you know, doing stuff on premises, which is obviously very different from operating in the cloud, let alone operating with the serverless technologies. One of the common challenges I've seen clients run into with this kind of migration is it's not so much the technical, but it's usually the cultural side of things. Was there any particular challenges, or I guess in terms of that, making that cultural shift, that, you know, that mindset shift that you guys experienced, and did you find any, I guess, patterns towards making that transition easier for your engineers?
So when we first started out, we started out with very, very few team members internally, and that kind of formed into component-based teams, which I believe was Basket, Checkout, and a few other functions within that space, which worked really well to get us up to speed and get us moving, so the ball was rolling. However, ultimately, when you're talking about a customer journey, it interacts with all of those parts, which created silos, created knowledge silos, and the culture. Because it was so new, people were engineering in a certain way, so those patterns didn't often replicate between architectures and between teams. So when it came to testing it, that, I think that was the limitation that really made us think, well, how can we make this better? Because each team could confidently say, my system works. But with the limited communication that was happening and knowledge sharing, it got to the point where you could only really be certain that the solution was working in production. or in a integrated environment. And that came with its own challenges. So as we've kind of learned that, we got the ball rolling, it's great. And we've iterated a few times on that now. We now kind of loosely work towards the Spotify model. There are a few exceptions in there. And the business being, I think there's 20 odd teams with us now. So there's quite a large spread of people and quite a large roadmap to deliver quite frequently, was to move that needle and make sure we've got the space for engineers to talk to each other, for knowledge to be shared, for patterns to be shared. And that we still kind of really like the Spotify model. And it works to make sure that we've got the right people in the right teams that we could upskill in the right way. I obviously part of the engineering chapter, and that's really helpful to be able to pick up like little initiatives from different places and hand them around and say, guys, have you seen this? Rather than relying on like a central source or a central guru that's going, this is your direction, go. It allows the teams to come up with their own solutions. And if we believe it to be innovative or cost saving or performant, we then make a really good point of sharing that around, because they've built it, they've got the knowledge of how and why they did it that way. And it's in order to enable that, we don't really have approval boards. We have like review forums, and that can be bringing feature and architectures to a open table forum, really, that allows anybody to attend and contribute, whether it be security, a production person, product person, or another engineer. We like that kind of forum to be open, to be able to ask the smaller questions around, oh, why have you done that? How do you thought about this? This looks different to what we've done in the past. How do you explain that? And it really brings the level of engineers up to a really good standard to be able to engineer it themselves in the future if they haven't done it before.
And I guess a part of your role as a principal engineer is also to be that kind of bridge between different teams and to help them communicate and share ideas and also identify common challenges, common patterns, so that you can help those ideas propagate across multiple teams. And I guess in some ways, maybe working on some of the tooling or automation or guardrails so that people just get the best practices out of the box, as opposed to having to kind of remember to implement something in a certain way every single time. So I guess a question there in terms of making that cultural shift. One thing you talk about in terms of the just like testing, making sure that your system is working before it goes into production. How do you do integration testing? I imagine you've got lots of different teams now. They all own their own services. They have to often talk to each other. Do you have any patterns around making that testing easier so that you can detect, problems? Sometimes, for example, one team may change how their API responds to a request. Maybe they realize, oh, right, we're returning 502 where it should be a 404. So for them, that's a bug fix. But then if other teams had been using their API, they've been kind of relying on the fact that this API returns 502 when the item is not found, but now they're going to change to 404. How to make sure that those communications happen reliably and people can find out these kind of breaking changes early?
I'd say we're still on that journey. That's a very present challenge. I think since replatform serverless, given all those mindset and education changes, each team have somewhat implemented their own testing pyramid. I think that's fair. Some opinionally better than others. I'm very passionate at making the services quite siloed. But I think there's limitations to that on how everything works, and just the way that the system has organically grown, some boundaries may have been overstepped, and then that's part of our integration tests. So we're working pretty closely to make sure that we're able to confidently release each system independently into production. I don't think we've fully achieved that yet. I believe we're well on the path to achieving that, and there's many teams that are passionate about engineering it in such a way to make that happen. But as part of the scaling we've seen, I think that has been a very present challenge and a great opportunity for us to improve on how we can confidently deliver software into production. So I don't think we've got really a solution or a pattern. I think the testing pyramid gets brought up very frequently, and lots of people are love a great conversation about it, me included. So it's definitely an area that we could move forward on, I think. It's fair.
Right. I mean, this perfection is not something you ever achieve, right? It's something that you strive for.
Exactly.
And if you aim for perfect, you're going to get those. It's good enough or great.
I think I personally find that really difficult because there's so much out there, like some of the courses and some of the blog posts that you've written and many others have written as well. They lead in a great direction, and I think I get on board with most of them. The challenge is there's always an exception, if that makes sense. Like, as a principal engineer, I'd like to think I can provide a fairly good reasoning to why, how to do it this way, or why to do it a certain way, how to take a certain approach, and back that up quite confidently. But there's always the devil's in the detail. It's always, isn't it, that lower level but, or it depends if. And I find that really, really, like, personally a struggle to get around, because sometimes you're like, this really makes sense, and then you go and present it to a team and they go, oh yeah, but our integration is not that flavor, or it's a slightly different thing, and you're like, oh okay, I need to rework that to be able to be more confident in getting that release out.
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges of being a consultant. Pretty much all your answers is it depends.
Yeah.
And there's something that works for like a large company like yourself, so it's probably not going to work, or at least not going to be the best solution for a two-man startup who just want to, you know, do things in the cheapest possible way and the fastest possible way. The people's criteria and their needs and wants are different. And so you always have to kind of just tailor your solutions and your answers. It's tough. You start every conversation every answer with it depends.
Yeah.
And there are like 10 different things that is going to, you know, change your answer later on as you find out more and more.
I think we're always learning, right? I think there's that level of we're reading so much from the web. We're taking so much from many resources that exist. And I feel that they're moving in a really like an enterprise level way now. I think at the start, it becomes a very, very simple hello world example, and you're like, well, I can't really do much with that in an enterprise organization because there's so many other considerations to have. But now I think we're in a position of maturity where a lot of stuff out there is starting to talk to those really complex systems that enterprise organizations are actually using.
Yeah, I mean, Lambda itself has gotten more and more enterprise friendly. I mean, from the fact that a couple of years ago they removed the VPC cold start penalty, and VPC is practically mandatory requirement in the enterprise. So loads of customers before it was couldn't use Lambda because of the cold start penalty that they had to deal with. And they've been gradually making Lambda work better for enterprise customers, including the whole, you know, snap start for Java applications. With a lot of enterprises still running stuff in Java with millions and million lines of code in Java, you can't just rewrite overnight. They keep improving things to make Lambda and just serverless in general much more enterprise friendly. No solution, and I think that's a really good thing. I think that shows a lot of maturity that we are seeing now in the serverless community, and who are actually adopting serverless technologies these days.
Do you find that comes with a level of danger as well? Because there's so many options. It's so easy to pick something off the shelf and go, oh, I'll just plug that in and play that. Do you not find that's also a danger?
I'm not sure if danger is the right word, but it's definitely a lot more complicated and complex. There's in terms of the options. There's like maybe 20 different levers that you can pull. But then I think for most people, for me, like 90% of people, you can just leave all those additional advanced settings. Just don't touch them. I mean, nowadays for my own projects, I'm probably still using the same, sort of default way that you do Lambda, uploading zip files, JavaScript, no VPC. So a lot of the things that's come out in the last couple of years are, I think they're designed to unblock use cases, especially in the enterprise. But at the same time, they are released to everybody. So regardless whether or not you need it, those things are, you have something that you have to kind of think about and you have to make decision on. So it definitely becomes something that, I guess, there is some danger there that someone would try to use, say, container images where they don't really need to, and then introduce more complexity into their deployment pipeline. Maybe someone using, some other feature like provision concurrency without knowing the cost implications, how that's going to affect the monthly billing. And suddenly they may be surprised that, why do our Lambda functions got so expensive? And things like that, which becomes, something that you can more decision you have to make, the more chance, I guess, potentially you can make the wrong decision that's going to impact you in some negative way. I guess
that's a great segue into a very recent thing for most people. It's the CDK, right? Because CDK is fantastic. It's code, it's application and code and infrastructure all in this typically the same language. But the way that you can create your business rules around the constructs and then get your business to utilize the constructs, I think that allows so many teams to remove those perceived dangers or complexities. Like maybe it's a default stance of the company, everything's in a VPC, or maybe it's an S3 bucket policy of private by default. You can apply all these over the top, and I think that's a really good way to govern that in a really friendly way.
Yeah, so CDK is interesting. Personally, I'm still not a big fan of the CDK because I think with CDK, there's just not enough guardrails in terms of how you structure your project. So as a consultant who works with many customers, one thing I often find is that everybody is structuring their CDK project differently, so there's no convention. So I go to one customer, they'll be doing it completely differently to the next customer I go to. So in that case, you always have to understand study two different applications, one for the CDK and then one for the actual system itself, whereas compared to things like SAM, server framework, framework that has more opinions about how to structure your resources, how to define them. It makes things a lot easier in terms of having that convention, that standard everybody just follows. Having said that, the CDK in the enterprise, like you said, the ability to create the L3 constructs is super useful. It's a super powerful way to create those, I guess, almost like a baseline, I don't want to say platform, but baseline resources that everyone will be using instead of the L2 constructs. You have your own custom L3 construct for Lambda functions that configures your VPCs, configures certain things in a particular way, and everybody can follow just without having to reinvent the wheel. And so I think so for enterprise, that's actually really, really useful. And I'm seeing a lot of enterprise customers adopt CDK because of the ability to use custom L3 constructs, especially companies that are really security conscious. Have a few clients in the finance sector, and the CDK means that they can just take a lot of the boxes, and there are plenty of boxes to take from the security team, and so they can do all of that just once and create their own custom constructs, and then everybody would just have to use that instead of having to figure out how do we meet like these 10, 20 different security requirements that we have to meet to go to production. So I think that is super powerful. Having said that, I think one of the prerequisites is making sure that every team is using the same language. Also, I guess the potential danger there is that if you are still sort of doing a lot of gatekeeping. So I've seen companies where everything have to go through a centralized ops team or infrastructure team. So you can't deploy anything yourself. You have to go through this team. And if you use CDK there and you support different languages, then you create a big bottleneck in your infrastructure team that have to support CDK applications in languages that they don't use themselves, and they're not the application developers themselves. So that becomes something that's really difficult to deal with. So if you've got the right cultural sort of structure and then the organization structure in place where people have rather development teams have got certain level of freedom to choose the right tools for themselves, but also to be able to deploy their applications to their accounts, which have got many guardrails and monitoring stuff in place, then I think CDK is going to work out a lot better for you than maybe some of the, companies who haven't gone through that cultural shift, that cultural education to be able to trust the developers to do the right thing. Well, trust but verify, and also educate the developer to do the right thing, as opposed to just putting gates everywhere and everything that goes through this one team, and you got to create this massive bottleneck. So I've seen examples where that ends up badly, but also at the same time, if you put in some of the hard work to educate your team, to level them up and to teach them how to do the right things, then CDK can be a really powerful tool in the enterprise.
Yeah, I think we've kind of, so we're not full CDK by any stretch. I think we started in 2018, so you can guarantee there's some services that have been built and then they're just on maintenance mode, for want of a better phrase. So we actually, Sam, CloudFormation, CDK, they're all existing in our estate in their own right. Sometimes you're right, the complexity of CDK is unnecessary at certain points. But equally, if you go all in, it can be really helpful. I believe we've combated a lot of that by having a single pipeline. And I don't mean single pipeline as in like deploys everything. I mean like the pipeline is a shared resource that everybody uses the same pipeline. So we've managed to get security scanning. We've managed to get all these gatekeepers, I guess, but they're automated. So you can deploy this, you can't deploy that, or we need to go through this process to get that deployment out. But then also facing into developer feedback, because sometimes they take quite a long time. Can we run them in parallel? How can we run that? But ultimately we're running three flavors of AWS resource creation, IAC, through the same pipeline. And the decisions and the guardrails are largely the same. Obviously, sometimes CDK, obviously, because you have to synth it to get the CloudFormation out of it. But there's a few nuances, but ultimately it does go through all of our pipelines are pretty much the same thing, which allows teams to pick and choose what they wish to use, or have confidence that if they're picking up a service that needs a new feature that hasn't been touched for a while, if it's in SAM, any of the new guardrails that are required will be alerted during the pipeline, as opposed to we're potentially releasing something vulnerable into production. It can be caught in that same shared pipeline, which is maintained quite well.
Okay, I see. So in that case, if multiple teams are trying to deploy their services, can they do that in parallel so that they don't have to wait for... Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. We've got multiple, so we use GitLab, I think I'm okay to say that. and it's like a number of shared runners that are picked up, and then we apply it to that. So yeah, many pipelines can run in the same space. And we also run branch builds and things like that and using the same runners. So it's all as early as possible, we will inform the engineering of a potential misconfiguration or something that we need to be sorted before it actually goes into a production environment.
Okay, gotcha. So just the pipeline configuration itself is all centralized in one place so that all the guardrails, all the security checks, all of that is happening, you know, and configured in that one pipeline that everybody uses.
Yeah. Yeah, there are obviously variables that you can pass in from your own repo, but you use the shared pipeline and then pass in that configuration, which can play nicely with your configuration, whether it be maybe you're deploying monitors via some the scripting language, or whether you're using Terraform in that library, that they can be pulled in and dropped out, modularized quite nicely.
Okay, I see. So in terms of, I kind of touched on this earlier, in terms of education, what do you guys, educate your existing engineers, and also how do you make sure that when you onboard a new engineer, they are quickly caught up to speed on both the sort of technology that you use and also in terms of your internal processes, any sort of caveats that, that you guys are doing specifically within your context?
So we have teams that own services to a degree, which allows the knowledge to be shared quite easy. So an engineer will join a team and then it's very, very, very heavily prompted that new engineer is taken through the architecture, the deployment processes, because they're so shared, once you know one, you probably know quite a lot of them, or you'll have at least some familiarity. So we're not too concerned about the far-reaching services that maybe your team don't touch at this point in time, but certainly in the early days, it's very much a case of get to know the engineers that you're working with, get to know their styles, input where you can, but we're not expecting you to fully pick up and run like some of our more experienced engineers that have been with us for a while. So it's very much like pair programming to get the process through and introducing them to maybe where their passion is first. So if it's architecture or if it's React, we can try and address those quite early on to make sure that they feel like they're contributing. So it's a bit of a learning curve, but a bit of a confidence boost in terms of I can code that, I can do that bit. So I'll do that and execute that really well while I'm learning maybe an AWS. I think we commonly use like the phrase like T-shaped engineer, and that's what most of our engineers are. So they've got a real depth in something, whether that be AWS, whether that be databases or React or CSS or what have you. but they have a breadth across the whole piece. And typically we'll try and address the ones that the bigger gaps to make sure they've got at least some knowledge, so it isn't a completely new thing when they have to work on it in a few sprints time, for example. But there's that. I think they're always buddying up with people as well. So we have quite a thorough onboarding process to make sure that not only is the education for what's missing there, but they're also bought on board with, maybe they haven't worked in an enterprise business as big as ours before. So just making sure that that's kind of, that feels comfortable. But then also meeting the team. So we have a fairly structured team topology, but we really like them to have the involvement with every single person from a networking level, not just a work level, to make, because most of us are hybrid these days. It becomes that, but I think that's where the challenge lies. So to have them to be very close to the team, although they may be quite distant in terms of mileage or location, but it's really good to have them having those kind of conversations.
Yeah, T-shaped is how I'll describe myself as well, that is, I kind of know enough about lots of different topics, but then really just, you know, really sort of focus on the, and specialize in the one particular sort of subset of skills. And I think in my sort of previous companies where I did a lot of recruitment stuff, we also like to just, you know, try to identify within a team, like which bits of the skill set that we are missing, so that we're trying to hire people with different T-shape or at least, you know, speciality, so that hopefully within a team, you've got enough coverage or people who are really good at, you know, databases, front-end, infrastructure, DevOps and testing and things like that. So then you've got people who are, you know, T-shaped in different, with different specialities and things like that. So I think, yeah, I definitely agree with what you guys are doing in terms of picking people who are, you know, who are generalists, but then with some specialist expertise in certain areas.
The key behavior is curiosity. I think we'd love to have the environment and culture across the board that is just one of curiosity. If you don't know, that's okay. Ask, because at one point someone else didn't know either. And I think some people may be quite reserved to ask, but if someone else asks, they also learn. So it's a huge opportunity to just keep being curious, because ultimately some of the technologies we're using are moving so fast that what is correct one day is maybe discouraged on another day, as new versions of things come out or new releases come from AWS within their serverless space. So you have to consistently be curious around what's next. And that really, really kind of lights that fire to keep that T-shape moving and keep that team really on board.
Yeah, curiosity is an interesting one, because I find it really difficult to sort of, to identify within the interview process. I mean, for one, you don't really spend enough time with the candidates, but also I don't think I've ever met a candidate who tell me he's not curious.
That's true.
He's not like a fast learner. Everyone says that they're fast learner. Everyone says that they're learning something, but it becomes quite hard to actually just identify, you know, the actual behavior that trying to sort of forecast how curious they can be. So that's one of the things that I like to hire people who are curious, but then it's quite difficult to balance looking for someone for people who are spending a lot of time on open source projects and trying all the newest, the latest and greatest technologies, with the fact that, you know, some people got family and they just don't have as much free time to be able to spend on contributing to open source projects and things like that. But equally, they're just as capable. And once they're in the workplace, for the stuff that they have to learn on a job, they're actually pretty good with going out and finding out the information they need. But also work with people who just, just don't ask any questions. But I just couldn't, I never found out, what can I do at the interview, during the interview process to identify people who are just lacking that curiosity.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't think I have an answer for that. I think it almost becomes, dare I say, gut feel, right? You've either got it or you've not got that gut feel. And sometimes it's not right. But curiosity is just, I think it's just so key. But when people have got it, you can really get alongside them and think what's next. I think I remember a few interviews ago, I was asked, how do you innovate? I think at the time I may have got one child. So like you say, contributing to open source as well as manage, like being with a family is quite a challenge. So I was like, well, I just do it in the workplace. I think back to the technical design review that I mentioned, that's a place where you go with your, like, you're presenting your best innovative solution. It might not be what you end up with, but at least you're using, like, to try and say, if everything goes perfectly, I'm going to use this integration with this piece. I'm going to use this new thing from AWS because it takes away the Lambda. But ultimately, we all know as an engineering chapter that if a business requirement is there, the right resources will be created as a fallback because of the business logic that's required or the hiccup that means you can't communicate that third party in that way. But at least you're able to present your best like intentions. Like if everything was perfect, this is how I would engineer it. And then work backwards from there. It's quite a nice place to be.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm a big fan of direct integrations and use them as much as possible, especially with AppSync, which has got its optimized integrations with DynamoDB and things like that, which makes it a lot easier. And that's one thing I hope that they do with API Gateway, just improve that direct integration, because VTL that you have to write with API Gateway is just a bit nasty and it's just not as easy as, say, AppSync or even step functions.
Yeah, I can't say I've tried AppSync too thoroughly, but I've definitely seen some of the releases that have come through recently with, I think it's the JavaScript resolvers and stuff like that. Yep. Just makes it, again, it brings it that much closer to CDK kind of, like it's that paradigm, isn't it, where you go and writing application JavaScript or TypeScript, you're writing, and it's just a familiarity of the language. As long as it's all integrated, like implemented correctly, it's perfect. But I do agree with you that the API Gateway is a challenge. Particularly when you're looking to create a mock API gateway, that's always a bit of a hurdle. But once you're there, you feel such a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, they should make it easier so that you don't feel that, I've done something clever here. It should just work, right?
Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess you guys started 2018. It's been 5 years in the making. And are there any sort of success or failure stories that you can share publicly?
Yeah, I think in terms of the platform itself, there's no way that we would have gone through COVID and come out still growing with the numbers of the traffic we're seeing and retaining as a market leader in homewares if it hadn't been for a replatform that we've achieved. We achieved it in, I think, fairly a quite short space of time comparatively to some. And I think there's still things in there that need to be deprecated, but ultimately the platform is safe, secure, performant, as much as it can be. So there's been huge successes there, and we wish to all definitely take pride in the way that it's come together. And I think challenges, they're probably on a slightly smaller scale, but because of the asynchronous nature that you can deliver with serverless, it's largely gone customer unnoticed. I can't pull on exact times, but actually the use of like dead letter queues and SQSs and those kind of patterns that mean that you can ultimately recover from any failure if you implement the right patterns, then it's just superb the way that you hand that responsibility over to someone else. If you architect it right and build it right, you can recover within hours hundreds of thousands of messages. If that were the case, I don't think it's ever got that big, but there's been times where we've had to recover from that, but it's not been as detrimental as it could have been had we been on the original architecture.
Okay, so is there any sort of like a throughput numbers that you can share publicly in terms of, okay, before COVID, this is kind of the amount of throughput we're dealing with, and then after COVID, we're now at some other level?
I don't think I can.
No worries.
I think it's really, really difficult. I actually find this quite a difficult thing to present anyway, because what we had before was it was a platform, but as we replatformed, it wasn't a like for like. It was very much a, whilst we're there, we're going to build this capability and this one. And so you couldn't even compare apples with apples. It's very much the traffic growth is a continued upward trend, but in terms of like sessions and metrics, and the platform is receiving less of a squeeze because of it. So it's a really difficult metric, and I'd love to start to sit in front of you and say, we've seen a 200% increase in traffic because of this, this, and this. But unfortunately, it's a really difficult metric to tease out, just because we've continually added features and iterated as we've gone through the replatform. To go like for like was never really on the table, especially with an unknown stack, really. We've from a WebSphere Commerce place right across to a React serverless application. It's the whole thing is just such a different way of thinking. that it's kind of impossible, unfortunately.
No worries, sir. No worries, sir. But has there been any sort of like a failure cases that you can share? Things that hasn't worked out as well that as you've hoped?
I honestly can't think of beyond the odd third party outage that we've had to kind of work around, or we release things in a very iterative way. So in terms of like we make heavy use of feature flags. We've got heavy use of experimentation on the site. So when we release things, if something was to show signs of not performing too well, it's really, really simple for us that we've put the things in place that we can dial it back. So I don't think we've ever been putting ourselves in positions unknowingly that could make it detrimental to us. Both from there's just that mindset of how do we get something from our local machine, even though earlier I alluded to the challenges that, and the opportunities we've got around testing and that confidence piece, we still put in, we as part of our processes, we put things in place to mean that if it's dropping off conversion rates, or for example, we can dial things straight back. We use that both for security of our platform to make sure our key journeys are working, but also as a way of experimenting with our customers to ensure that the changes that we're proposing that are made are actually seeing the moving the correct needle, whether that be performance or revenue. So it's, I'd love to say yes, but actually as a principal engineer position, I'm happy that I can say no, that there haven't been any, because they're typically quite small that we can deal with quite nicely because of the things we put in place, the observability, the tracing we've got, the alerting, the Google Analytics, which obviously every business is using Google Analytics, especially ones in retail these days. So to have that available to us and act upon it means we can do such pull things so quickly to make it still a platform that performs where we need it to be.
Okay, you mentioned the feature flags. That's something that I'm actually really interested in. How are you guys? How have you implemented your feature flags capabilities?
So first of all, it was internal. So we had very simple. Like WAF that was controlling cookies that we're setting on and off, that we could roll out accordingly based on a percentage base. So we moved in a very simplistic way, but it worked. It was because it was quite simple. It was quite easy to understand, get your head around, easy to get through. We've since started to move towards LaunchDarkly as our feature flag provider, because it just has that extra level of personalization and the extra level of control that we are starting to require as a business to make sure that we can move and correctly divide up and report on how the site's performing in different buckets and audiences of people. I think there's definitely a drive to move into the personalization space to make sure that we're offering all of our customer ranges the customer journey they deserve. And it's how to identify those and act accordingly to make sure that the customers stay loyal as they can be to Dunelm.
Yeah, I love LaunchDarkly as well. Do you, in that case, use LaunchDarkly from both the front end and the back end as well, using the front end to, I guess, to customize some of the user experience, but then on the back end, potentially doing, you can also use LaunchDarkly on the back end to do canary deployments as well, so that if you're not sure if this new bit of code is actually going to work, you can also just quickly turn it off if you need to.
It's typically front end. I'm not aware of any back-end services that are using it today. That's not to say that we won't use it. I think it's another little tangent to the mindset, because you would typically want to be 100% confident. But I'm sure there are use cases where we would need that functionality to be able to deliver a feature flag from a back-end service. It's not something we use today. So it's purely front-end. I mean, if you've spoken to Luca recently, or you've seen some of the AWS posts and Dunelm posts from my blogs, etc., we're moving in the micro front end space. One of my colleagues is kind of fronting that and able to move forward on that for Dunelm. So we're moving in that space, which kind of came hand in hand with the introduction of LaunchDarkly, to make sure that we were able to confidently go with micro front ends while also being able to make sure that we were safe while doing it.
Okay, I will look for that blog post and I'll add it to the links in the description below so that if anyone else wants to read about your journey to microfinance, they can have a look at that as well. Microfinance is also a very interesting topic. Luca actually came on here to talk about that a little while back. And Luca was the one that told me all about, that taught me all about microfinance while we worked together back at the Zone. So interesting to see how you guys are doing with that, because I know we had some really interesting challenges with microfinance. Because at the Zone, we had to make sure the front end runs on some archaic devices that's only available in certain countries like Japan or something like that. So
wow.
They had some really interesting challenges on the front end side of things, which I never thought existed, having to run on like a customized version of HTML and stuff like that, which is, but microfinance, super interesting topic as well. Really glad that you guys have been talking to Luca about that.
Oh, well, some would say he wrote the book, but he did. So
yeah, he did.
If anybody's the guy to talk to, I think from an AWS point of view, and having him as a contact is super useful. He's been a blessing to us in both micro front ends and event-driven architecture, to be honest. And it's really helped in that space.
Okay, I think that's all the questions I have. Maybe one more. Seeing as we are still in the middle of a reInvent at the time of recording, lots of things being announced. Are there anything that you're hoping for the next, say, 2 more days that we've got left? Any sort of personal 80% wishlist items?
I don't think anything over the next 2 days. I think there's lots I've got pinned. There's lots I've got saved. Our blog posts, etc., from the already released items. As I mentioned earlier, I'm particularly passionate about low code. So some of the integrations there, definitely looking to tease into with the step functions, HTTP APIs. But then there's also the cost optimization pieces that were there. If I remember correctly, there was some CloudWatch log storage costs that were released, along with a few, was it Aurora databases that had the scaling almost out of the box for you. Was super useful stuff to dive into, very early stages for myself after reading the blog, but there's definitely some things that I'll be diving into and trying to get to grips with, really.
Yeah, there's been some pretty big announcements already. I think the biggest one for me was probably the Lambda's scaling behavior change, so that you're no longer bound by that 500 per minute burst capacity limit. Well, post-burst capacity limit, incremental scaling limit on the regional level anymore. So now you can, especially I guess for enterprises, use cases where you have potentially super big spikes, you can now potentially use Lambda for a lot more things than you could before. The CloudWatch one is interesting because with the new log class, it's going to be a lot cheaper, but at the same time you can't use a subscription filter, so a lot of companies that a lot of people that use a subscription filter to process the logs, that they'll have to find some other way to potentially pull CloudWatch logs and then process them that way, using like a cron job as opposed to using subscription filter. So I imagine quite a few of the vendors that I know that already use a subscription filter will have to think about how they're going to do that going forward if customers was to do that. And I think that also works nicely with the new Lambda's logging control, so they can log, I can have the same log group for multiple Lambda functions. So I was actually quite disappointed with that change when it first came out. But then I think it does make sense for people that use CloudWatch and CloudWatch logs insights mostly. I've been using other vendors, so for me it's just okay, another piece of config that you have to make. But if you're using mostly CloudWatch logs already, it actually makes life a lot easier to be able to put all of your logs in the one place, and so that you can use CloudWatch logs insights more efficiently.
I think we also use another vendor for our logging, log capturing, and like APM and monitoring, etc. But I'm always trying to keep an eye on what's available within the AWS console. I think some of the most powerful stuff, it has to come from them first, right? At least the access to it, whether the implementation is different. But there's also some stuff. I think we saw the EventBridge metrics coming out. So that was something I wanted to make sure that I was able to dive into, to make sure that it was how we could use it, what we could do, given that we're trying to move into the event-driven space a lot more aggressively. How can we save ourselves from any of those challenges if we were to get the metrics arranged early, and the x-ray and the tracing and all of those. It's good to keep revisiting them, especially the OTEL has been, it's coming through a lot stronger these days, isn't it, with to make sure you're kind of vendor agnostic, but there's also the event driven side of that. And when you're using direct API integrations, what does OTEL look like there? Because you can't instrument your own code because there's none of your own code. So it's always quite, I also find that quite a good read.
Yeah, I think I'm going to spend quite a bit of time after reInvent has wrapped up to actually go through a lot of these changes and actually try it out myself, because there's been quite a few of them that that piqued my interest, besides all the AI stuff that they just announced in the last 2 days.
That's one thing that is kind of flying under the radar for me at the minute, just trying to pick up those nuggets of information that can help Dunelm have the best serverless platform possible, really.
All right. So I think, I think that is going to be the end of all my questions, Mark. Thanks again for taking the time to talk to us today. Is there anything that you want to sort of mention before we go? Are you guys hiring? Is there anything that people can go to learn more about opportunities at Dunelm and or potentially, you know, look for opportunities to work with you?
So unfortunately, at the minute, as of right now, I don't believe we're hiring. But there are definitely places to go. I think, Jan, you mentioned putting the MFE details within the description. I'll also share the Dunelm blog, which kind of gives a bit of a sneak preview as to how we operate, what we do, some of the cultural things we've got going on, and some of the events that we run internally, from hackathons to IT awards. And that kind of gives an insight into Dunelm's technology, really. So I can share those with you, and you can add those if that would be fantastic.
Yes, please. If you share that with me, I'll put that in the links in the description below, and so people can then go and find it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for today, Jan. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and goodbye, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.